I am Planta on the line. This is thecommentary.ca. Canada's international literary sensation Linwood Barclay joins me now. The best-selling and critically acclaimed novelist is here to discuss his newest book, Fear the Worst. It has been described as page-turning, intense, spellbinding, and compelling. In the book, car salesman Tim finds out his daughter, who's staying with him for the summer, has vanished. He thought Sydney was working at a local hotel in his suburban Connecticut. However, when he checks there, they've never heard or seen of her. And so ensues the story, asking ourselves how well we really know the ones we love and what lengths we would go to protect them. Fear the Worst is published by Doubleday. Linwood Barclay is a 2009 recipient of the Arthur Ellis Award. He is a former Toronto Star columnist, and his two previous books, Too Close to Home and No Time for Goodbye, were number one bestsellers in the United Kingdom. His website is linwoodbarclay.com. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program, Linwood Barclay. Good morning, Mr. Barclay.
Good morning. Please call me Linwood. It's nice to be with you today.
Thanks for joining us. Do you watch the Today Show regularly?
The Today Show? Quite often, actually. Yeah, because it does show up in the books occasionally, I think. We often have the Today Show on in the morning when I'm getting breakfast ready and so forth.
Is that a show that you enjoy watching, or?
It seems kind of... It is kind of a nice mix of news and a bit of froth and silliness, I suppose. But I do at the end of watch it. I used to watch Canada AM all the time, and then this is back when. And then when Valerie left, it just didn't seem the same, you know.
Yeah.
But no, it's good for. I kind of like when I get up in the morning. I'd sort of like to know what's happened overnight, if there's anything particularly major in the world. And CNN kind of exhausts me at times. Today's show will usually give me the highlights.
How old are your kids?
Our kids are, my son is 25, and our daughter she's 22 now, she'll be 23 in a few months.
So, I mean, in writing this book, one gets a sense that you were, I'll ask you, are you afraid for your kids at times?
I was going to say not a whole lot more than most parents are. I think all parents are fairly, you know, full of anxiety about their kids. And I'm not sure that that's something you ever get over, but it's certainly true when they're at home. Especially when you have teenagers, it's like, why aren't they home yet, or where are they, or why isn't the car back, or what's going on? I mean, I find it's sort of a kind of constant state of anxiety, sort of the teenage years. But we're through that now, thankfully. I think actually it was not too bad, but when you're in the midst of it, it tends to be, you know, anxiety, a little bit of anxiety with that.
So could you describe Sydney for us?
Sydney is, she's a 17-year-old girl, her parents are split up, she's, I think, a pretty good kid, but she's done the odd thing wrong here and there, like a lot of teenage girls do. She's fairly independent-minded, she's actually got a fairly good head on her shoulders, I think, but she may not have always made the best in terms of the friends that she has and things that she's done, and she runs to a little bit of trouble in this particular book.
Are your kids like Sydney at all?
No, I think that, I don't know. I think both our kids have pretty good heads on their shoulders, and my daughter has always been pretty wise kid. In fact, she's the kind of person who's always been willing to kind of push the envelope, and I mean, when she was 19, she decided she wanted to go live in England for 4 months, and just to prove that she could fly solo, and This would have been about a year and a half after she'd gone all the way to New Zealand for a Habitat for Humanity project and built a house down there. So she's the kind of kid who's pretty smart when she's out there on her own. And I went to visit her when she was in England, and she'd only been in London for about 6 weeks, and she took me around that city like she lived there her whole life. So our kids are pretty much on the ball. But, I mean, when they're in their teens, I mean, just like all kids, they sometimes think they're invincible, or that nothing bad could really happen to them, and often turns out they're wrong about that.
Some of the critics of the book say that you're perceptive of the teenage condition. How were you able to capture that?
Well, I'm pretty close to my kids, I think. We've always been a very close family, and I like to listen to how they talk, and I think I kind of, as best one can when one is, you know, in your 50s, can kind of understand what they're going through and the kind of anxieties and the problems that they have. And so, because I have worked from home for a very long time, I've been there to sort of just be to be the fly on the wall, or to be there with them when their friends are over, and so I know how they talk. I love how they talk. I love listening to them, and I just think I have a sense of what worries them. I mean, my own kids would probably tell you that I'm incredibly out of touch, but I do think I have a sense of what it's like for them, and as I say, I like listening to the way they talk and capturing that.
Was there something from your own childhood or your teen years, I should say, that informed your writing this book?
Not so much one, I don't think. My teen years, I think, were quite different than most. I mean, my family had a cottage resort and trailer park up in the cottage area of Ontario. And when I was 16, my father died. I ended up running the family business. I kind of had to grow up overnight. And I was looking after my mom. I was looking after a brother who was suffering from mental illness. And so I had my hands full right at the age of 16. And so all those sort of problems or little kind of bits of trouble that a lot of teenage kids can get into, I didn't even have a chance because I was too busy. So my situation was a bit unique, I think. But I think that experience has, more than anything else, shaped my life. But I don't know how much it shaped this particular book.
You mentioned growing up. How when was it that you wanted to write? Did you always want to write?
I had always wanted to write. I mean, I think probably around grade 3, I started filling those little Tilroy notebooks with entire stories. I was so interested in writing that around grade 5, my father taught me. He gave me like a 5-minute typing lesson because I found handwriting them was just taking far too long. So we had this old Royal typewriter that was weighed about 500 pounds probably, and he said, okay, here's where your fingers go. This one hits this key, this one hits this key, and that's your end of your typing lesson. So I started typing at that age in grade 5, and all the bad habits I learned I kept to this day, I'm sure. But I was always, right from the get-go, I wanted to write. And I think that in many ways, the thing that most inspired me was television. I loved, I was a kid of the 60s, and I loved TV. And I would have favorite shows, and I'd think, well, one episode a week is not enough. I need more. So I would take those characters and invent my own adventures and stories for them. And so I'd be writing like 30, 40, 50-page type stories when I would be in grade 7, 8, 9 of all these particular shows that I loved.
Do you still watch other than the Today Show, do you still watch dramas and
yes,
things like that?
I do. There's a lot of stuff that I really love that's out there. I suppose probably among the current favorites are things like Mad Men, and I'm a huge Lost nut. I love Lost. And so there's a lot of stuff out there that I really do love and do watch. Shows that some of which have gone now, but things like 6 Feet Under and... I'm trying to think of a few others, but a lot of stuff that I think there's so much television now. People say that it's just absolute garbage, and I think it's true that some of the worst television that's ever been done is being done now, with reality shows and so forth. But at the same time, I think some of the best television that's ever been done is being done now, because we're using the format of television, or 16 episodes, whatever, to unfold these really long, intricate, complicated stories, and the form television allows you to do that in ways that movies can't. So I think there's some really great stuff now.
Now, in terms of your writing, did you always want to write suspense novels?
I would say, yeah. When I was in my teens, I mean, by the time I was 20 or 21, I had written a couple of mystery novels, sort of standard detective novels, which were never published, and that's probably a really good thing. Not that there was any published, not that anyone was even remotely interested in having it happen, so it wasn't like it was a near miss or something. But it was the kind of thing I was all drawn to, because as a kid, I think the first books I read were probably the Hardy Boys, and then I was reading all of Agatha Christie's mysteries, and then I was finding all of the Nero Wolfe novels by Rex Stout, and then somewhere in my teens, I started discovering Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett and Ross MacDonald, and those kinds of detective fiction that was a little meatier, a little more involved. But it was I've always been drawn to that, and so when I wanted to write fiction, that was the kind of thing I wanted to do.
Now, Tim Blake, he's the dad in this book.
Yeah.
He's a car salesman. Do you see yourself in him?
Well, there's probably some of me in him in that. I mean, I wrote four earlier comic mysteries back a few years ago about a guy named Zach Walker, and he's probably more like me. He's kind of me unchecked. He's full of riddled with anxiety and trying to do well, but not too well. Tim, I think somewhat. I think what I like about Tim Blake and what I like to do with my novels is I like to have my heroes are just ordinary people. They're ordinary people caught up in extraordinary situations. I don't write about cops or CSI guys or ex-military types. I just write about ordinary people. And as far as, to the best of my knowledge, this is the first thriller in which the hero is a car salesman that has ever been done, because they're not what you call typically heroic figures. But I think the fact that he's just a regular guy and the kind of anxieties, the kind of worries that he would feel about not being able to find his daughter, I think I can sort of easily put myself into his position and think the way he would think about, you know, being in that kind of situation. What would I do? How would I handle it? And even though my personal situation and life is very different than his.
Now, you've had a great deal of success abroad versus yes. success here in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
You've sold more books abroad than in Canada, is that right?
Well, yes. I mean, even it's that's for sure. I mean, of course, the Canadian market is, by comparison to some, is a smaller market. But my success overseas has been, in a couple of places, has been kind of amazing. A couple books back, I did a book called No Time for Goodbye, which has been, last I checked, is now coming out in about 35 languages. It was a massive bestseller in Germany before anywhere else. And then last year, No Time for Goodbye was the single best-selling novel in the UK and did about something like 650,000 copies. Last I heard, it's now about 750,000. And the books have been doing very well in the U.S. and Canada, but not quite on the scale, of course, as they have been doing in England and Germany and some other places.
How badly do you want success here?
How badly?
Yeah.
I feel very blessed with the kind of success I've had so far, and I feel very fortunate, and the things have gone very, very well for me. And if things didn't get any better, I would have nothing to complain about. But one likes to do well on your home turf. And so I'm hopeful that more people will discover these books that I'm doing, that people here in Canada and in the U.S. Will find them. And things seem to be trending in the right direction.
The success in Europe that you had a few years ago, was that a surprise for you?
The success overseas?
Yeah.
It was. I mean, it was quite amazing. I mean, it was certainly, I'd be the first to admit, it was certainly helped by, in England, there was a show called Richard and Judy, and they had a book club that had the same kind of effect as an Oprah book club.
Right.
And when I was told that they had chosen No Time for Goodbye as one of their 8 reads for the summer of last year, being the kind of pessimist I am, I thought, well, this will be the first Richard and Judy book to tank. because even though most selections by the Richard and Judy club go on to the bestseller list, I figured, well, mine will sell like 5 copies and that'll be it. But what happened was No Time for Goodbye became the biggest selling book in the history of the book club. And that amazed me. And I think what that book club got sort of launched No Time for Goodbye into the stratosphere, but word of mouth kept it there, because even by the standards of that book club, the sales for it were rather astonishing. And then the book that came after it in the UK, and here a book called Too Close to Home, well, we were curious to see what would happen when that book came out, because a lot of times people are loyal to the selections of a book club, but they won't necessarily follow an author from one of those books to their next book. So we thought, well, what will happen with Too Close to Home when it comes out, not being a Richard and Judy pick? But it went to number one. It knocked John Grisham off the number one spot in March. And then when it came out in paperback this summer, it spent 3 weeks at the as the number one selling book in the UK. So it looks as though we've sort of moved past the Richard and Judy thing. People have found my books and they just really enjoy them, and which is really gratifying.
And you're able to travel over there? They seek you out there, do they?
Yeah, well, in fact, my UK publisher sent me on a tour. I was gone all of July, but I didn't go to England. They sent me to Hong Kong, Australia and New Zealand, and I was gone for all of July touring those places. And then I got home, and I was home for about 10 days, and then I did an 8-city tour in 8 days in the U.S. So it's been a pretty crazy year. I mean, Fear the Worst is the seventh novel I've done, but it's the first that any publishers have wanted to finally thought, you know, we should start touring the skies. I've been kind of all over the place this year.
Are you one of those writers that thinks that this is the best novel over the other ones that you've written? Or the next one is probably the better one, maybe?
Well, I think, I honestly do feel that Fear the Worst is my best novel. I think I felt that No Time for Goodbye had been, up until now, even Too Close to Home, which I think is a really terrific book. I thought that was it was a tough act to follow, No Time for Goodbye, because it had been such a huge hit. And it was sort of inevitable that people would say, well, you know, Too Close to Home's not bad, but it's not as good as No Time, which, because it was so successful. But Fear the Worst is the one I feel is the best. And it's the one that I feel that holds together the best for me. I'm very pleased with it. And the next book, in fact, is already done. It's a book called Never Look Away that comes out at the end of March, sort of 1st of April. And I'm pretty happy with it, too, but I think so far, Fear the Worst is my favorite of all the ones I've done.
Do you read the reviews of your books?
Yeah, I shouldn't, but I do.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and you can read 10 really good ones, then one bad one, and that one ruins your day. And perhaps once you've been at this even longer than I have, you get a bit hardened to it, then just stop worrying about it. Because it's interesting, they'll be all over the map. The very things that one reviewer will love your book for, love about your book, the next reviewer will hate it for all those same reasons. So sometimes you just have to just think, you know what, I just can't worry about this, and just let it go.
As a writer, do you find that you have to read more, perhaps, than the average person who's not a writer?
Well, I've always read a lot anyway, and so I don't think I'm reading any more now than I ever did. I'm not a speed reader by any means. I know a lot of people say, oh, they can read a book in a day, or they read a couple books a week, and I'm usually at least a week with a book, or two, and so I probably get maybe 30 books or more read a year, but I'm always reading, and I no longer just read within my own genre. In fact, I probably read less of that than I used to. I kind of read all kinds of things now, and I think that's probably a good thing.
And it informs the writing, does it?
I think so. Well, I mean, when people will write to you and say, who are aspiring writers, and say, well, what should I do? And my advice to them, and I think it's actually advice I ripped off from when Stephen King wrote a wonderful book called On Writing, and that is to write, but also to read. Because you can learn so much just by reading lots of different writers and with different styles and different genres and fiction and nonfiction, and just be reading. And I think that probably informs you as much or more than anything else.
How big an influence was Margaret Lawrence on you?
She was very big influence. I mean, she was a really close friend and a mentor to me when I was when I was in university. She was a writer in residence at Trent University, where I was attending. And so I thought, okay, here's a woman who makes money writing books. I hadn't read anything of hers except maybe a short story or two in high school. And so I went to see her and brought her all these things I'd written, and she read them and critiqued them, and we had a wonderful chat. And then over the summer, between sort of my, whatever it was, second and third year of university, I felt terribly guilty and thought I should really read her stuff. And I read all of her books over the summer. And I came back in the fall, and I said to her, and she must have thought I was the biggest jerk in the world. I said to her, you know, I felt bad that you'd read all my stuff and I hadn't read yours, so I read it over all your books over the summer, and, you know, they're pretty good. And thankfully she laughed. I don't know if she meant to, but she was really a mentor. She was very encouraging to me. She was a good friend to me and my wife Nisa, and she was a kind of larger than life person in some ways. I mean, she was very spiritual and something about her that was quite amazing. And as I say, she was very encouraging and supportive of me. I remember when I was at the Peterborough Examiner, my first newspaper job, and I'd covered some immense fire, and I took all these pictures, and I had the whole front page full of stuff, and the phone rang, and it was Margaret saying, "Way to go, kiddo! You got the whole front page there." And she was a great lady.
Linwood, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Continued good luck with this book.
Thank you so much. It's been great. Thank you.
You're very welcome. The book is called Fear the Worst, published by Doubleday. LinwoodBarkley.com is his website. Linwood Barkley on the line. I'm Joseph Planta.